produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Daily Audio Stash is where responsible marijuana smokers listen in on the latest news about cannabis, hear the voices of the marijuana law reform movement in special segments and interviews, and kick back with comedy and music no other podcast can offer. It's Normal's Daily Audio Stash. More information at normalaudiostash.com. First up today, it's news from Normal. Our news today, new growers may be sought for Canadian medical marijuana. The Canadian press has reported that people who want to grow pot for the Canadian federal government may soon get the chance. Health Canada's five-year, $5.75 million contract with its current supplier of medicinal marijuana, Prairie Plant Systems, is about to run out, and the department is preparing to seek proposals from all potential suppliers. As it does with a wide range of contracts from building maintenance to military supplies, the Canadian press reported that the government will invite interested companies and individuals to submit bids for a pot-growing contract. It will then try to choose the one offering top quality and value for taxpayers. The process could result in Prairie Plant Systems being selected again, or some other supplier could get approved. The Canadian press also reported that some who use the current pot supply are urging the government to shop around.
What we need is to move beyond the idea of a single monopoly producer of medical cannabis.
That was Philippe Lucas, a medicinal marijuana patient and spokesman for Canadians for Safe Access. He continued,
"The end users of this product, Canada's critically and chronically ill, would benefit from having additional options for access."
According to the Canadian press, about 280 patients currently receive the government marijuana, which Prairie Plant System grows in an unused section of a hard rock mine near Flin Flon, Manitoba. Most patients buy 30-gram bags of ground plant buds for $150. Canadian press reported that many users returned the initial batches of the underground marijuana, saying it was too weak to relieve their symptoms and it was also too dry. Prairie Plant Systems made changes in 2004 to boost the levels of THC and said return rates dropped to less than 2%. According to the Canadian press, Health Canada's contract with the company expired last December. It was renewed until the end of June and has been extended until September 30th. It's not clear whether there will be further extensions or whether the government will call for bids before the end of September. When the Canadian government first sought marijuana supplies in 2000, Prairie Plant Systems won the contract out of a group of several bidders from British Columbia, Ontario, and other provinces. More information about this story on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Welcome back to the Audio Stash today. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to promote marijuana law reform across America. Join up at norml.org. Tuesdays here on the Stash, we discuss patient and medical issues. And first up is a short talk we had with Philippe Lucas of Canadians for Safe Access and the Victoria Island Compassion Society. Phil is a unique resource, as he's also an approved Canadian patient. We speak with him here on The Stash today to look further at the Health Canada news story. Philippe Lucas is the founder and director of the Victoria Island Compassion Society and is a research fellow at the Center for Addiction Research in British Columbia and is himself one of the 1,300 authorized medical marijuana patients in Canada. Phil, welcome to the Audio Stash today. Let's talk more about this Health Canada story. Will Canadian patients have a little bit more variety in their medicine here in the future?
No, it looks unlikely. We've been pushing for a number of years now for a decentralization of this federal program with the idea that we need to increase the options for end users of this of medical cannabis in Canada. We need to increase the options for access by recognizing the good work of community-based organizations like Compassion Clubs and societies, and we need to improve the supply that's coming from the federal government in the first place. We have some serious questions about the quality and safety of that federal supply. And additionally, Health Canada right now is only making a single strain available to end users, and it's simply not enough. Anyone with experience with medical cannabis knows that different strains tend to address different symptomologies or to relieve different conditions, and just making one strain available is simply not going to work as a shotgun approach towards a medical marijuana relief.
Now, Phil, tell us, how do patients gain access to medical marijuana in Canada as opposed to, say, California?
In Canada, it's a long and lengthy process. There's a 29-page application that must be sent in to Health Canada, which includes sending in picture ID, the support of a physician, so a physician's signature, and in most cases also the at least tacit acknowledgement of a specialist as well. Then the process, once Health Canada receives the application, can take anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months. And so what we're seeing right now is a system that's really broken down. California, of course, you only need a single doctor's recommendation, which you can then take to a dispensary. And I think that is actually more in keeping with the way that we treat other medications. And it's certainly a system that Canada should move towards. The system I like to point to is actually Oregon. I think that Oregon's a great comparison with the federal medical marijuana system over here, because both medical marijuana program started in 1999, and Oregon has exactly one-tenth the population of Canada at 3 million people versus our 30 million people. And yet, despite that, in the state of Oregon, they've registered right now through their state-run program 15,000 medical users in the 6 years the program's been in existence. In the same 6 years that Health Canada's totally federal program has been in existence, they've only registered 1,300 users. And so we're seeing that there's a block at the bureaucratic level right now that's just not being easily overcome by Canada's critically and chronically ill.
Phil, thanks again for joining us here today on the Audio Stash.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Keep up the good work, Chris. We'll talk soon.
We have links for Canadians for Safe Access right up at normalaudiostash.com, and we'll be speaking with Phil again here on the Audio Stash in the future. Canada and Canadian patients offer unique models for us here in the United States. Next up today, some PodSafe music from Podshow.com. Here's Rachel Can.
Even my skin listens as I stare down the serpent, as even Eve's skin listened as I even now listen, each pore opening to the hiss, as the hiss trickles up, jumping cables, electricity crackles, and my heart stops between every beat and starts again. Grace notes expanding past the horizon. My skin listens, even my skin listens, as even Eve's skin listened. But don't worry, this doesn't mean anything. I mean, seriously, don't worry, this doesn't mean anything. But somehow I got your scent on me, right here, just above my wrist, just below my hand, an expanse of no man's land I had been saving for your olfactory deposit. But I wonder, how exactly did your smell get on it? It's not like we were touching at all. Actually, I take that back. I do recall me unable to resist rubbing up against you for half a second. Actually, I take that back. I do remember being unable to resist rubbing up against you for like half a second. Don't worry, this doesn't mean anything. It's just even my skin listens, as even Eve's skin listened, as I stare down the serpent, as I even now listen, each pore opening to the hiss, as the hiss trickles up. Into the thrill of compromising situations, we ride down the free fall, ecstatic slide of synchronization. It's like even my skin listens, as even Eve's skin listened. Don't worry, this doesn't mean anything. It's not like we were touching at all.
That's some PodSafe music from podshow.com. Rachel Cann, we have links to her right up at normalaudiostash.com. Next up on the stash today, we'll speak with Rick Doblin of MAPS. Rick has spent the last 7 years trying to bring medical marijuana through FDA approval as a prescription medication. Director of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, known as MAPS. Rick has been instrumental in the fight to bring medical cannabis through FDA approval. Rick, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
It's a pleasure to be here, Chris. I'm really looking forward to talking to you.
Rick, we've covered the subject of clinical cannabis monopoly happening here in the United States. The National Institute for Drug Abuse controls all the research marijuana. First, tell us how this agency came to have this control.
Sure, Chris. Well, it's actually a historical anomaly that has made it that NIDA has a monopoly on the supply of marijuana for research, but they don't have a monopoly on LSD, MDMA, psilocybin, ibogaine. Virtually none of the other Schedule I drugs does NIDA have a monopoly, and none do they have a necessary enforced monopoly. The reason is because historically, 37 was the Marijuana Tax Act, 1942, or some people say 41, marijuana was taken out of the pharmacopoeia, and there's not been any private production of marijuana since that point. There's been research into the use of marijuana for mind control purposes and other things up until middle 60s or so. That was seized marijuana. And then NIDA was empowered to grow marijuana for research into what's basically what's wrong with marijuana. And this was even before the idea of the medical use of marijuana was more popular and more accepted. And so NIDA, whose mission is what's wrong with marijuana, now has control over the marijuana for people that want to look at what's right with marijuana, at how it could be used medically. And so there's an inherent conflict of interest. And NIDA has not just very low-quality marijuana, but they also have a review process for protocols that fundamentally obstruct privately funded research. So that as long as NIDA retains the marijuana and this monopoly on the marijuana for research, we are not going to see marijuana developed into an FDA-approved prescription medicine.
And this has been put to the test in a case in Massachusetts that's now almost 7 years old. Rick, tell us how this case developed at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst.
Well, in the 1990s, I recognized that it was really going to be necessary to try to do the FDA-approved research on smoked and possibly also vaporized marijuana to develop marijuana into an FDA-approved medicine. And so I started working with Dr. Donald Abrams at UC San Francisco on looking at marijuana for AIDS wasting. And we had FDA approval for the study. But then, as I mentioned, NIDA's review process, they refused to provide the marijuana, even though we had an FDA-approved project. And that delayed this project for years and prevented it from taking place. Then I also worked with a Dr. Ethan Russo to try to do research into marijuana's use in treating migraines, which historically has been used for quite a long time for that. And we also got FDA approval for a protocol, and yet again, NIDA refused to provide the marijuana for the study. Now, whenever you want to develop a drug into a medicine, the agency that evaluates the protocols and then evaluates the data is the FDA. NIDA has absolutely no role whatsoever. And we were not actually even trying to get the marijuana from NIDA for free. We were willing to pay for the marijuana from NIDA. Now, what that told me is that as long as NIDA retained the monopoly, that it would not make sense financially for anybody, any private sponsor, to invest money into making marijuana into a prescription medicine, because you start ending up spending initially hundreds of thousands of dollars, and then you start spending millions of dollars on research, and you're supposed to negotiate with FDA. But if NIDA inserts itself into this policy, this process, I mean, and refuses to provide marijuana for FDA-approved projects, your drug development effort is fundamentally obstructed. And so it became necessary to try to break the government monopoly on supply in order to develop marijuana as an FDA-approved prescription medicine. So in the year 2000, I started looking around for somebody who could apply to DEA for a license. And I had, you know, in my mind these imaginary criteria that this person would need an expertise in medicinal plants. They would probably ideally be located on a university faculty, because at present, you know, Dr. El Soli at the University of Mississippi grows under contract to NIDA. So the only marijuana that's grown for research is grown at a university. And I figured that would sort of emphasize the research aspects of it. Then this person would need to be senior tenured faculty to resist any kind of pressure on the career that would be placed on them for applying. And it turns out that DEA did try to put a lot of pressure on Dr. Craker, who I eventually found, to withdraw his application. And then this person should have no connection whatsoever to anything to do with marijuana legalization efforts. And ideally, you probably never even have tried to smoke marijuana. So I had these ideal criteria, and then it took me a year to find somebody. Again, Professor Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst, and he met these criteria even better than I could have imagined. He's the editor of several journals on medicinal plants. He's an experienced horticulturist. He's actually grown plants in secure environments when the U.S. government was looking for various bacteria and other things that could be used to destroy cocaine and other kind of crops like that. So he's already worked in highly secure environments, and he's committed to research. He's not a proponent of marijuana legalization. He just believes that science should come before politics. And so in 2001, we started the application process to the DEA. So this is now over 5 years that we've been trying to get this license. And DEA initially, you know, as they, DEA's strategy is a strategy of delay. They cannot win on the merits. So what they try to do is just delay and delay and delay. And that they're willing to sacrifice public health, honesty, integrity, whatever, in order to delay. So they pretended to have lost his application. So the first year, well, it took 6 months or so, and then we said, what's going on? They said, we lost the application. So then we submitted a photocopy of the initial application. Several months after that, I called them and, like, what's going on? Well, we can't accept that because it wasn't an original signature. It was only a photocopy. Well, you guys lost it. So then we move forward and we get 5 Massachusetts congressmen to write a letter to the DEA saying, we support Professor Craker's application. We support private production of marijuana. We want to see the controversy of their medical marijuana resolved through scientific research. That's the way it should be done. And then the head of the DEA, Asa Hutchinson at the time, wrote back finally to say that there was international treaty obligations that prevented DEA from giving the license, which is bogus. And after that letter was sent back to the 5 Massachusetts congressmen, shortly after that, Dr. Craker received a very mysterious communication from DEA. It was an envelope with no, it was a DEA envelope stamped from DEA, but it had no specific person on the outside of the envelope that it was from, and there was no cover letter, nothing inside. All there was his original application date stamped to show that it had been received exactly when we sent it in, and the DEA had had it the whole time. So I don't know if this was like a whistleblower inside DEA alerting us to the fact that they actually had the application. More likely, it was just somebody at DEA thinking, okay, Asa Hutchinson has addressed this issue. There will be no private production facility, so here's your application back. But what it did do was put the lie to this whole story that DEA had lost the application. So then over and over and over, all sorts of things happened. We resubmit the application. We get the support eventually of both Massachusetts senators, Senator Kennedy and Senator Kerry. We find out from GW Pharmaceuticals, well, we're aware of GW Pharmaceuticals, which is producing marijuana in England for marijuana extracts. We get in touch with the Home Office and find out that the contract between GW and the Home Office acknowledges the international treaties but shows exactly how they can be addressed so that there is no obstruction, blockage from international treaty obligations, and on, to the point where DEA finally, after 3 years, puts a notice in the Federal Register, which is what they're supposed to do upon receipt of the application, announcing that this is open for public comment. Public comment takes place. The only person that applies is Professor El Soli for NIDA, and he objects and says, you know, he can supply whatever we need, and he doesn't think it's necessary. So then almost a year goes by after that, and DEA doesn't even do anything. So then we have to sue them under the Administrative Procedures Act, arguing unreasonable delay. And the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals says, DEA, there's some question here about this issue of unreasonable delay. What is your response? And so instead of trying to defend this unreasonable delay, DEA finally said no. And they gave their reasons why they said no to the application. So this, ironically to us, was a tremendous victory. The fact that we got DEA to say no in this world counts as a victory because now we could sue them on the merits. And that's what we did. We've had over $200,000 worth of pro bono legal services provided by the American Civil Liberties Union, lawyer Julie Carpenter of Jenner and Block, and Manuel Jacobowitz of Steptoe & Johnson. So we have tremendous representation. We've had great witnesses. The DEA witnesses actually ended up helping our case more than their case. And on May 8, 2006, the final legal briefs were submitted to the DEA administrative law judge. And now we wait. We wait to see whether the judge will recommend to the head of the DEA whether to grant Professor Lau Craker's license or whether to reject it. Now, we've seen before that the administrative law judges are independent of the agencies for which they work, so that we've had remarkable rulings from Judge Francis Young, who recommended that marijuana be made into a prescription medicine. Of course, His recommendation of the head of the DEA was rejected, and he also recommended that MDMA be available for prescription use, and that also was rejected by the head of the DEA. So we have a very delicate situation in that if the recommendation from the administrative law judge is negative, basically we're sunk, and marijuana will not be made into a prescription medicine through the FDA, and we will have to rely either on state and local efforts or on some effort through Congress. And if the recommendation is favorable, then we'll have a several-month period within which we can try to focus pressure on the head of the DEA to say yes, to accept the recommendation, instead of reject it. But either way, we win, because if the recommendation is positive and the DEA decides to say yes, then the door is open, we negotiate with FDA, and we start our drug development effort. It's going to be expensive, it's going to be timely, I mean time-consuming. It'll cost in the neighborhood of $5 million, it'll take over 5 years, but we'll get science and scientific data, really, to evaluate the potential medical use of marijuana. And I think, particularly with vaporizers, so that heat marijuana that don't burn it, where you avoid the combustion materials, I think that we can make a really strong case to FDA that both from safety and efficacy reasons that marijuana should be made into a prescription medicine. However, if the DEA gets a favorable recommendation from the judge and they decide to reject it, then it's just obvious and transparent that there is no route through the FDA to make marijuana into a prescription medicine, that the federal system is hopelessly biased, and that we need relief, again, through state and local efforts or through Congress.
Rick, thanks for joining us today. And where can folks find out more information about the case?
And we're on the web at www.maps.org. We have the transcripts of the legal case with the transcripts of all the witnesses. We have all sorts of supporting documents about the legal case and about the production facility project. So I encourage people that want to learn more to go off to our website.
Rick Doblin is founder and president of MAPS, and we have those links at normalaudiostash.com. With questions about cannabis, you can contact National Normal or your local Normal chapter for more information about medical access and links to other patient groups. We have links to the Normal chapters page right up at normalaudiostash.com.
Hi, this is Keith Stropp, founder of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as Normal. When I founded the organization in 1970 to create a national discussion on the need to legalize marijuana for responsible adult use, no one honestly believed that 36 years later, marijuana would still be an illegal and untaxed commodity. However, since Normal began this important advocacy effort, 12 states have decriminalized the possession of marijuana, and 11 states have passed medical marijuana laws or voter initiatives, meaning that over one-third of the American population lives in a state or municipality that has reformed their marijuana laws. Isn't it time that Congress step in and pass national legislation to reform marijuana laws? Let's finish the job of legalizing marijuana once and for all by you and your like-minded friends joining and supporting Normal's long-standing advocacy. You can learn more about Normal's marijuana law reform efforts or become an active supporter by calling toll-free 888-67-NORMAL or by visiting www.normal.org.
This has been Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Thanks to Rick Doblin and Philippe Lucas for contributing to today's show. For all the great pod-safe music, we feature the band Carne Cruda as our theme. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. at AFID Interactive Media for the podcasting technology. We're back at 4:20 tomorrow. If you listen to the Audio Stash, cast your vote at Podcast Alley or other podcast directory services. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. The podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.